My name is Brian Finnerty, member of the National Board of RCC and Communications, National Communications Director for Opus Dei. Welcome to our panel on the evolution of religion reporting in the media. I think it's wonderful for us to be able to be here in New York City, a media capital. And we've also seen so much change in reporting in religion on the media. Some of us may have noticed that there are fewer reporters who are dedicated to reporting on religion these days. That poses a great number of challenges. There's been the whole evolution of social media. There's been discussion about certain edginess in contemporary culture. And so this, we're very fortunate to be able to have this panel. We're also very fortunate to have such a distinguished panel here. I'm going to introduce our moderator, who's Deborah Mason, who is among the leading scholars and trainers on how religion is portrayed in the media. She is the director for the Center on Religion and the Prophet. Thank you. She is the director for the Center on Religion and the Professions, part of the Missouri School of Journalism. She's also directed since 1997. She's directed the Religion Newswriters Association, which is the professional association for journalists working on for training journalists on, especially for the secular media, on how to cover religion. And I've had great privilege of being able to work closely with Deborah, by the way, in preparation for the papal visit. We worked together in organizing a seminar on Pope Francis and his visit to the United States, and that was a real privilege for me to be able to work with her on that. She's the publisher emeritus of Religion News Service. She's compiled great many resources for journalists on how to cover religion, like religionstylebook.com. Anyway, she's well prepared to moderate this panel, and I'll hand things over to Deborah. Deborah, thank you.
Welcome, and thank you very much. Yesterday, Jim Forbes referred to you guys as the lepers, and today you have the wolves up here. So we're the wolves. That's in the Bible. Google tells me 13 times. So thank you very much. First, I'm going to introduce our panel. The way we're going to work this is a roundtable, similarly to yesterday's plenary, and I'll be asking the group questions, and they'll be taking turns to answer. Also, it is being recorded, and we hope to leave some time at the end for questions and answers, and Brian will have a mic, but please come up here to ask your questions so that it can be recorded and so that we don't have to repeat them, and that would be really great. So I'm really pleased to share this stage or panel with a couple very long-time and well-distinguished journalists that I've known very well, and a new journalist who I'm just meeting. So I'll do them in order here. Rachel Zoll has covered national religion for Associated Press since 2001. And before joining Associated Press national staff, she worked for AP as a staffer in the Boston Bureau and as a Southeast regional correspondent based in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She was also the manager of the Rhode Island Bureau. Another familiar face is Kim Lawton. She's an award-winning reporter, producer, writer, and editor for Covering Religion, Ethics, and Culture. She's the managing editor and correspondent for the highly acclaimed national public television program, Religion and Ethics News Weekly. And Kim is a frequent commentator on issues of faith and spirituality of major magazines, television networks, and so forth. I'm sure you're all familiar with her work as well. And then Hussein Siddiq is a senior television news producer who's worked for CNN, CBS News, and most recently Al Jazeera America. He covers politics, current affairs, and business news. As a broadcast journalist, he's covered numerous stories in the Islamic world, as well as the Muslim experience in America. So I'm just going to set up the conversation with a couple of realities, and Brian alluded to some of these things. But of course, for the first time, at least in my knowledge, for the first time we've had a religion story win an Oscar, in essence, in the form of Spotlight. the movie Spotlight that covered the that was about the Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning effort to discuss to uncover sexual abuse, systemic sexual abuse cover-ups in the Roman Catholic Church. And the Religion Reporter, if you saw that movie, he was mentioned twice, but never on screen. Michael Paulson is mentioned twice. He was at some press conference one time, somewhere else, at any rate. But that was their investigative team that that did the bulwark of the advance work, and then he did a lot of the follow-up work. In other ways, we've got that sort of high, and you may not perceive it that way as religious communicators, but for religion journalists, we kind of perceive that as a recognition of important work, but it's also a low in that we have religion news sections, which began in the late 1800s, are nearly extinct. And those sections, that's where the bulk of the media industry's non-deadline, non-conflict news appeared. And I'm sure you've noticed their absence, because some of the stories that you're trying to promote and to see covered, that's where those stories would often appear. And those sections are really almost totally gone. In addition, as you know, the nonprofit models are of news that are starting to breathe new life into religion news are not quite figuring out, you know, they haven't quite figured out how to make money, significant money online. So that's one of the challenges. And then at RNA, our biggest growth has been among freelancers, among scholars, among people working for nonprofits. And the number of people working at metro-sized papers, so not the largest outlets and not the smallest outlets, but mid-sized places like Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis Star, religion reporters are really disappearing at that size media outlet, as I'm sure many of you have noticed. Well, of course, we're not meant here to be a prophetic voice. We're meant to be an informative voice, and we're meant to talk about the truth, not the big T truth, but the little T truth. And that's very much a difference from the kind of work that you do. We're not the man bites dog, we're the dog bites man story. And that has always been a challenge and a source of tension between the work that you do often and the work that we are really mandated and do. So with that introduction, I'm going to start with the first question here, and that is, I've asked them all to name the number one most important thing that you think has changed about religion coverage today compared to when you did your first religion story. So, do you want to start?
Sure. Hi, first I just want to say thank you for the invitation, and also thank you for all the work that you do. So many of you have to take calls from us at odd hours, and with very short deadlines, providing information about very complex things like votes at meetings and general conference and voting by order to general convention, et cetera. And it's we're just grateful. We don't always say it enough, but we're grateful for the work that you do. I know that I couldn't do my job without some of the news services that that exist for the different denominations. So all the writing that you do, we read it and we appreciate it. I think the greatest change on religion coverage for us has actually been social media, and the way that has actually allowed us a greater view into the nations. Before, you know, it might be a situation where we'd make some phone calls to talk to a pastor or the head of a denomination or a leader in the church, but now what we can see is in real time discussions and reaction of a certain policy decision or a development in a particular area of the church. And that actually is great for us because it gets more voices into the story, it adds depth to the story. And also one really practical effect of it has been that when you do have your major meetings where you're making decisions, we can see in real time what's happening on the floor from a variety of sources. So we don't, it broadens the discussion, and there's more transparency is the word that I would use into their religious life, the life of different churches.
Hi, everybody, and I agree. Thank you for inviting us. Of course, whenever they go first, they always get the answer first. So I was going to say what Rachel said. Definitely social media and online technologies, I think, are the biggest change in terms, I've been at Religion and Ethics for 19 years. Hard to believe the show's been on the air 19 years. And during that time, I think that has been the biggest change for us. Absolutely, the way Rachel said, just in terms of how I cover story, Twitter is now my, AP newsfeed. And, it's just on and on with keeping up as a reporter, covering things. But then also for me personally as a reporter, it drives me nuts because when I'm out and about doing my reporting, some of this is the nature of our show, the fact that it is a television program and I am on air, therefore, you know, a face of the show on social media. But when I'm out reporting on a story, I'm no longer just worrying about what I'm going to ask my source, but I'm also having to worry about, ooh, did I remember to tweet that I was going to be here? And is somebody taking photos of me interviewing this person? And then, you know, having to post it on social media and tweet about it and Instagram and Facebook. And then, oh, did I actually have a story I was working on here? You know, so that part has really been frustrating for me, trying to figure out how do I, as a reporter, manage all of that while I'm actually still trying to do my job. But it has, because we're a weekly show, because we now have this online technology, that the rhythm has changed completely. And so I am getting information out there on a more frequent basis than I was just on a weekly show as well. So it's opened up amazing opportunities for us to tell the story, but now there's this big giant beast that needs to be fed all the time. And that's the hard part.
Thank you for inviting me to this event. I think social media is a big part from the point of view of television newsrooms, and I've worked for national outlets, but I suspect it's the same thing with local news outlets as well. Budgets, newsrooms and news directors are not allocating funds for specialized religion reporters like before. When I first started television production or television news production, I mean, we would go out with a full team of a correspondent, a producer, a sound tech, a cameraman, maybe two. Now the reporters, in today's newsroom, a reporter's expected to do the same thing. It also affects specialization. People are covering more than one topic. So there isn't a specialization in religion reporting in a lot of television newsrooms, and that's different from when I first started.
I think that first question rolls a little bit into the second one, but then what is your biggest challenge and what in terms of covering religion today? And it's probably something similar. I'll start with Hussein down at the end, so we'll mix it up a little bit. But in addition to the things we've talked about, what are some of the challenges you see?
Well, playing off what I just mentioned, we do cover religion, but usually associated with a larger story. For instance, if it's politics, you know, when Governor Romney is running as president, you know, what do Mormons believe? If it's terrorism and 9/11 or the war in Iraq, what do Muslims believe because of what's going on? The stuff about the scandals within the priesthood and the Catholic Church, again. And I think because we don't have specialization, sometimes we fall flat when we're reporting this stuff, and we tend to refer to what opponents of these faiths or denominations think, or the stereotypes that they have, as opposed to getting to what the people in these faith communities think themselves. And I think that's a problem.
I absolutely agree with that. For me personally, I think the biggest challenge is, even after 19 years of a half-hour television program that focuses on religion, I still can't get to all the stories I would like to cover in this world. There's so much. And you know, they're the obligatory stories you have to do, and the stories based on things that are going on and times of the year. You know, all these different things go into it, and that's hugely frustrating on one hand, but on the other hand, it's a positive. You know, there's so much to cover out there, and that to me shows this is a lively, vivid, vibrant beat that needs to be covered. I think on a more broad scale, one of the biggest challenges I see, Hussein brought up to a certain extent, but it's just the budget and the financing of the coverage of religion and how that's really changed. As the newspaper sections that Deborah talked about, they're sort of moving into a sense into online, you know, into websites or a place on the web. And how do you fund that? Who makes money for that? And we saw with Crux, the Boston Globe, in the year when the Boston Globe's coverage of religion was in the spotlight, no pun intended, well, little pun intended, you know, the Boston Globe decided it didn't have the financial backing that it needed to keep Crux going as a website affiliated with the Boston Globe. They had a huge number of clicks and hits and reads and all of that, but the newspaper cited the financial part of it. So now Crux is going with a religious organization as a partner, Knights of Columbus. And that's great that they have the money, the resources to keep it going, because I think it's a very valuable outlet. But that raises a whole new set of questions. And I know both of them have said, we want Crux to be editorially independent. But, you know, when you're out there in the trenches, sometimes that gets really hard. And what if Crux, you know, the Knights of Columbus said, well, we trust Crux to do reporting for the good of the church. Well, that might be a little subjective sometimes. What is ultimately good for the church? But, you know, it's those kinds of questions. Should reporting be funded by a particular group in order to have it continue? And those are really hard questions.
Well, I'm glad that now it's my turn to be say the same thing as these folks have said. But, yeah, time and money are the problem. There are so many great stories that I wish that we could do that we just don't have the time or resources to do. As we speak this morning, my editors are having their weekly meeting on to allocate the money for different feature stories. I'm hoping that mine will get approved. You know, we're in a year where we have a very bizarre presidential election that is taking up way more resources than we expected. And the other thing, this might sound funny, but the Olympics also takes an enormous amount of money to cover. And so that means everybody, not just religion, everybody in the company is kind of cutting back a little bit on other types of stories that they can write. Part of it, too, for me at a wire service is that I have to cover the biggest breaking stories. Everyone has to do this to some extent or another, but sometimes I'll get pitches for great stories from other denominations, but, you know, Pope Francis did something interesting, as he does every day. And so I always want to say, I'm sorry, you know, blame Pope Francis, but I can't cover your event. So, I mean, that's quieted down a little bit, although it's going to pick up again next Friday. That's part of what goes on. And I feel guilty about it because I feel like we're ignoring some really important stories, but there really is only so much time to write about these things.
And I think I'll just add, it's important to note that the declension that's occurred for economic reasons to religion is not exclusive to religion. It's happened to environmental reporters. It's happened to women and culture reporters. It's happened to youth reporting. It's happened to a lot of different specialized topics. And so it's not unique to religion, although sometimes it's framed that way among people who critique the media. That's not an actual accurate framing of that. So one of the things that we're hearing more of and hearing more from RCC is this this idea of religious literacy. And I think, speaking of the presidential election, that maybe is a loud call for the need for religious literacy in our country. And so I wonder, you know, what role should the media play in improving religious literacy in the United States and really across the world? Is that our job? I'll start with Kim this time.
Well, and I work for public television, and our mission is educational television. So for that, you know, I'm very grateful because that's built into my mission, educating the public about religion, and I've been very grateful for the opportunity to do that, and we try to do that in a way that's different than you might see in other outlets. But I do think the media shapes so much of what people think and understand. It disturbs me when so much of it, as Hussein mentioned, is stereotyped. You know, faith groups are stereotyped because of what? Ignorance, maybe lack of time, shorthand, any number of reasons. But I think that's bad on us. We need to be better about that. And unfortunately, for a lot of people, the only way they hear about any other religious group is through the media, through what they happen to catch. They're not going to go and seek out certain websites that might help them. And unfortunately, more and more people can, you know, we're in a place where you only have to look at what you want to look at and what you agree with or what makes you feel good. You don't have to anymore hear stuff you don't want to hear. And so the media is one of the last bastions of, I think, public education in some senses. And so we have an obligation to, as best we can, help enhance religious literacy, literacy about religions, not, you know, fomenting or not promoting particular beliefs, but just being accurate and informative on what we cover.
Yeah, I'm sort of tempted to give a sarcastic answer to this, and that is that we don't play much of a role in improving religious literacy. It's it's painful for those of us who specialize in this to see some of the media coverage, see some of the basic mistakes. I always think about a professor I spoke with at Brigham Young University who said that he didn't think it was necessarily hostility to religion. It was just that people or reporters, some reporters, didn't think it was important enough to get it right, so that they didn't even bother. I think part of that, too, is that when you think about our public education system, there really is no religion taught, and even just religious history, that's taught in any broad way in the public school system, and reporters are products of that. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, we learned a song about how a bill becomes a law. I mean, nobody taught us a song about the difference between a Presbyterian and a Methodist. So, but I have to say, on the sort of more hopeful note, that one of the popular formats, or a format that's become more popular as news becomes consumed on mobile devices, is these things called explainers. And question and answer, they're just like chunky bits of, you know, trying to explain what the news was. It's not a new format, but I think it's become more popular because of it fits so well on mobile apps. And just as an example, after that horrific Easter tragedy in Pakistan with the explosion, our correspondent there did a great sort of question and answer explanatory piece about the Christians in Pakistan, their history, why they're targeted. And I personally found it incredibly helpful, and I see more and more pieces like that.
I completely agree with that. There are more things online now with these, especially with these explainer videos. I think they're well done. And what you were talking about earlier about your educational mission, in most newsrooms they are commercial enterprises, and my executives are obsessed with ratings and with clicks and. They're measuring them in all different ways, and unfortunately, they look at a lot of these stories and say, "Yeah, it's not getting enough play. Let's do something else." And that's the nature of the beast. But having said all that and acknowledging all that, we are the news media. It is our mission to inform the public, and I think that producers or reporters or news media personnel should it's their job to remind their editors and their executives that this is what we're supposed to do. And commerce aside, I mean, there are more lucrative businesses to be in than news. So, there has to be acknowledgement from both sides, but with all that, I would say that it is important that we do get things right. We do report beyond stereotypes. We do and I am encouraged by some of the stuff online and in the social media and in some of the non-traditional media outlets that are coming out now with these explainers and stuff. I still think we have a ways to go, and we are still doing stuff on the quick and resorting to stereotypes. And I think part of that is the diversity in our newsrooms. I don't recall meeting a Mormon in my newsroom. I wish I did. I would love to use that person as a resource. I've had people say the same thing about me, being a Muslim. So I think we should also go out and try to recruit people who have this specialism, who have knowledge, even if they're not specialized reporters. So I think that's important.
And I'll, again, just jump in and say I think it's a rare reporter who doesn't care to get it right when it comes to do with any topic, but religion is especially hard to get it right. And so it's easier to avoid it or omit it from a story angle than to, because they are pressured under time. So this is a little bit of a loaded question here, but if there was one religion story that you could wipe off of your plate for all time, okay, cover up your ears, some of you, perhaps, what would that be? We'll go back to you. Start with somebody else. Okay, who wants to go first? Kimberly? Kim, I'm sorry.
I had a long list, actually, of stories I don't like. But coming off, or in this current season, I think for me, it's the holiday stories that are so obligatory. And let's face it, 19 years, 19 takes on Easter, Passover, Ramadan, you know, Yom Kippur, on and on. And if we don't do something, people in the communities get really upset. Why didn't you pay attention to my group? And honestly, in some communities, we don't pay that much attention. So there are certain, you know, a Baha'i holiday or Sikh holiday or something that maybe we don't spend as much time covering those communities, and the holidays are just that great opportunity. But boy, oh boy, year after year after year coming up with it, that's hard for me. You can tell what I just did last week. So.
How about you, Hussein?
I agree with that. I also do business news sometimes, so I hate doing tax stories. That's in the same vein. In terms of a religion story, there was one that really I was assigned to cover, and I disliked the story. It was the controversy of the so-called Ground Zero Mosque in Lower Manhattan, and there was no way to cover that story except talk about what stereotypes and biases and why people were offended by a so-called Ground Zero Mosque and what it meant, you know, and then, you know, going back to 9/11 and all that. I just was sick of it. It actually had a lot of play. It got a lot of coverage. It got a lot of ratings coverage. And we went with it, and I just wanted it to end. And I think it was one of the more negative stories that I've been involved with. I wish I could have done more to go beyond stereotypes, but that was the story.
I think for me, it's not. I'm a little bit fortunate in that my editors have asked me to cut back on some of the holiday coverage. I don't have to do that anymore.
I'll give them my editor's number.
Okay. I think one of the things that frustrates me is with if you're all over the country. If you know that, and around the world. And so sometimes when the reporters are looking for the man bites dog story, writing about what's happening with a religious group or what are the important issues with a religious group, they'll find an outlier, someone who's protesting a policy, and maybe that person doesn't actually have any followers or any voice or any influence, but it's different. It's those stories get me a little bit frustrated because I don't think it really necessarily helps anyone understand what is happening in religion, but also that it gives an impression of something, that something might be happening when in fact it actually isn't.
All right, well, you're speaking to religious communicators here, so this is your opportunity to give them some advice. And so what one thing would you want religious communicators to know when trying to deal with either you or the media in general? So who would like to start? You want to go? Okay.
Sure. I would say in one way to keep doing what you're doing, answer requests as quickly as you can, anticipate. I think that's where I see sort of the best work being done by the communicators for different ministries and church groups, that they see something coming ahead, a meeting or an announcement or an appearance by a top leader or even a controversy, and that you're ready, you have background information ready, that you have someone available to explain either on or off the record about a process in the church. I mean, that's actually where I find one of the most helpful things. It's not necessarily about getting a quote or getting some video, although all of those things are very important. But it's hard sometimes for we have to cover all religions, and so to understand fully some of the very technical processes of how decisions are made, or even about the hierarchy, or what does this title mean in the church? All of those things are really helpful if you can be ready to explain it. The other thing, too, is I see a lot of emphasis, and this is really, really encouraging, on storytelling within your own organizations. And I know a lot of you have been journalists or are still journalists in some way, and just to keep doing that, find stories within your own religious groups that can help inspire us to find new stories to tell. That's helpful.
I agree with all of that, and I do like to hear from you all. I do like to know what different organizations are doing. I like to hear ideas. I like it when people make it as easy as possible for me to follow up on it. But please don't expect that I can respond to everyone or call you back or, you know, say thank you. As you can imagine, my email inbox is a nightmare. And after 19 years on the air, I'm on pretty much every single mailing list there is out there. And so I try to look at everything, but I absolutely made a decision a long time ago. I cannot respond to everything. But that doesn't mean that I haven't read it or I don't care about it or I may not come back. I may come back to it months later and say, you know, I think these guys were doing something along those lines. Maybe. So please keep that coming. And also, if you're, as you are, organizing events or pitching stories, please do keep the visual in mind and the audio. So much of our world is text or print oriented, and while that's important, for some of the rest of us, we have other needs as well. And so, you know, if you're organizing a press conference, please be mindful of what's in the background and make it easy for people to have sound that they have access to. Just sort of basic things that you'd be surprised how frequently those don't happen.
I agree with that. Access, you know, be there for us when we need you. I get a lot of emails from communication officers at different institutions. I get way too many. I don't read them all. I can't go through them all. But I am aware that I'm getting them. So when something does come up, especially like in a breaking news environment, you're the first people I think of. So I get very irritated when I do reach out after getting 50 million emails from you that you're not available. And so access is important. Awareness of our new cycle and what we're trying to get. So sometimes there may be something that you want to promote that really doesn't fit in, but with what we're covering. But there are ways to read into what we might be interested in, and I think and communicating with us, and you know, and I actually do like meeting people in person. Sometimes if communication officers or PR people are I work out of New York, so sometimes they do come in and they do request a meeting. I like that actually has an impact. I would say access is number one.
Those were the questions I posed you guys in advance, so now you're going to be at my mercy, and I'm going to pose questions that I didn't give you in advance. But actually, Hussein, that's a good segue into response times, because I know we have this problem particularly with scholars, too, in this 24/7 nature news cycle now. If you're on deadline and trying to get hold of somebody and you need a response, how do you get the responses you need? I mean, who ends up being quoted is a matter of who responds first, right? And so can you talk about that process and the importance of speed? And are there other ways via Twitter, what other ways can communicators make sure that they're responding to your needs?
Posting statements on social media, not just emailing them, can help quite a bit. I've been in situations where, I know like a big vote might be coming up related to gay rights within a denomination, and it's the advocacy groups on both sides, not the denomination itself, that ends up framing the conversation because they've anticipated what's going to happen. They've written up sort of their quotes in advance, and or even just background on the history of what it is that's being voted on or decided, and they're quicker getting back to us, and they end up shaping a lot of they get quoted, they end up shaping the story. I also think that if there's any chance for you to blog about the church, if there's something sort of ready-made and available about the background on an event that we can just grab from, that's also really helpful and doesn't necessarily have to be emailed, but if it's something that's available that we can read regularly to follow what's going on in your church, that is really helpful as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. Having something tangible that's easy to get to, whether it's a statement posted online and then tweeted about so that there is something official that we can get to as soon as possible, is really helpful. Again, social media, it's great, but then it's also a little crazy because you have to sort of know, I have various sources, well, this one likes to be contacted by phone, and this one is email, and this one is, you tweet, and this one you send a Facebook message, and that gets a little crazy, but sometimes I do all of the above if I'm really trying to get a hold of somebody. It's just this, this wild trying to get through in as many ways as possible. But definitely having stuff up there and having it up there in a timely fashion, I can't tell you how many times I get a press release with a statement on, for example, the Pakistan bombing or something, 2 or 3 days later, sometimes a week later, I'm still getting press releases about something. And even for a weekly show, I have a weekly show, but still, that in everything needs to be done as quickly as possible.
And can I just add one thing to that? It doesn't have to be a super formal press release. If you just tweet something, that we can grab that, as long as it's from an account that we know, then we can just grab that and put it into the story and get right in there. So
I affirm all that, and more. I would, I think it's great for speed, using social media or getting a release out quickly, and quickly for TV people is, yesterday or, 5 minutes ago. However, sometimes we reporters and producers need clarification, and I think access is still important. So if you send me a release, I would like to be able to call you, even if I get information on background. I have a question about what you're saying here. That's also important. And again, the time factor is important. So I would add to that, that still the access is important.
Great. And I think this question is a little bit related to that, but one of the things we very often, and rightly so, get accused of is only covering conflict. And again, in part, that is the dog bites man. Most of us who've covered religion for a long time, we expect you to do good work, right? That's part of what your mission is. But how, do you think that this clickability and this 24/7 media environment has exacerbated the dependence on conflict news? Or where are the openings for non-conflict news in today's media environment?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because some of the things that I've read about are actually some of the most popular stories online and on social media are inspirational stories, not conflict stories. Although conflict does get clicks, and you see this a lot. I'm trying to think of an example.
Just look at Huffington Post religion now.
Yeah, it's sort of those kinds of stories get a lot of play. Also, even though we have these analytics, meaning how many clicks did your story get, and we're counting them. Most news organizations don't exactly know what to do with that information. So
I was going to ask, do your bosses actually count the clicks? Does that matter? Do they say to you, oh, you can't cover that because last time you only got 400 million clicks?
No, it never comes into conversation. I mean, people will mention it. They'll say, oh, it was the, we'll count the top stories on our mobile app, and they'll say, but it's usually, it's almost meaningless in a way because Kim Kardashian, video of a cat wearing a top hat, and then it's, and Pope Francis released an encyclical on the environment. But it's up there, and that helps, but it doesn't necessarily hurt there.
Again, I think this is where online technologies really have benefited covering religion, because it does open the door to having more material out there. And so we've taken to, sometimes I'm doing a story and I'm somewhere. Recently I was at the Indianapolis Children's Museum and they had an exhibit about interfaith and teaching children about religion. Well, the day I was there, an astronaut, Dave Wolf, I think his name was, who had taken a mezuzah and a menorah up in space, happened to be at the museum because he's from Indianapolis. And they were like, oh, yeah, yeah, I interviewed the astronaut. Well, it doesn't really fit with my story about teaching children about religion, but, you know, he was there. So I interviewed him, and we did a little YouTube package thing that was on YouTube and on the web. It was more featurey, and now my story about teaching children, well, I had a little conflict, but it wasn't a conflict story. But, you know, anyway, having the online technologies offers the opportunity to tell some of those stories that aren't the headline stories, but are still as important, if not more important. And we found that the problem is having the people and the time to actually do all those variations.
I think there may be more conflict coverage, and I think it's because of the 24/7 news cycle and also the evolution of the news media. I mean, there are a lot more people going to war zones and sending stuff back, like, very quickly. And also, it's not just news outlets. There are a lot of freelancers that go out and do out. So I just think there's more access to the conflict stuff. So I don't think it's a coincidence that there is more conflict stuff being covered in the media. I would say, though, that I think some the non-conflict stories that we do, especially more lighthearted stuff, really does get play, and sometimes we're even surprised by it. But the truth is, we don't have to rely on conflict coverage to report information to the public, and that's what I think.
And if you look at, if you've followed the history of BeliefNet, for instance, and even now more recently the history of Huffington Post religion, you will see a bend towards spirituality coverage, less institutional coverage, and more upworthy sorts of coverage. So you're right, it is very popular, but it's also not institutional kind of news. So we have about 40 minutes, or 20 minutes rather, and we're going to turn it over to Q&A now. So Brian has the roaming mic again. Please use the mic to ask your question. Please ask questions and not statements. And if you have somebody specific you want to answer the question, let us know. Otherwise, we'll pose it to the whole group. So.
And can you identify yourself and your organization when you ask?
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
So come up to me to ask a question. I'll go ahead and ask the first question. I'm, as you know, Brian Finnerty, Communications Director for Opus Dei. Could you offer some suggestions on sort of like the balance for how people should contact you by email? Like sometimes there might be something which for like an FYI, which I might not expect to be a national story, but might somehow be incorporated into a story. But then again, I don't want to keep on sending folks so many different things because then it just gets drowned out and would never bother to look at my email. Yeah, so what sort of balance should people have, or what suggestions do you have about contacting you folks directly by email?
I don't mind getting more than one email, you know, maybe a couple or just, you know, because I do have so many that it's easy for stuff to get buried. I absolutely admit that. I don't want one every single day about the same topic. And if you do send me one, please do not follow up with a phone call, a tweet, and 4 Facebook messages to me. That drives me absolutely nuts when I start feeling stalked. Then I have to say my feelings aren't as open to what you might be pitching. But I don't mind getting more than one. It's a balance. It is. I don't know what the actual, numbers are. It depends on my mood, and it's hard for me to predict that at any given moment.
Maybe people feel free to line up as well while the question is being answered.
Mary Beth Kudal. I'm with Response Magazine, United Methodist Women. Can you remember a recent story you covered that used interfaith model? We are talking about getting more in line with spirituality as well as more issue-driven, but how have you covered ecumenical and interfaith work as well as specific faiths?
I can. I'm working on a story right now based out of Nashville about an effort between Muslims and evangelical Christians there to build relationships in the midst of all the anti-Muslim rhetoric that's been happening and just how they're negotiating that and trying to build relationships in the heart of, you know, Nashville. So I am working on that. We do a lot because we can cover, we have both the news brief format in our program, so we have short, I mean, they're very short, but we have a lot of them as well as longer feature stories. And so I'd say we do a lot of stories when at National Cathedral, all the different faith groups get together and sign a pledge that they're going to, you know, honor one another and not give in to bigotry or whatever. Especially, I will say, some of those were fantastic visuals for television when you had people all lined up together and signing a giant petition. That was great for TV, so we covered that. That was a few months ago. But things like that, I'd say my program, and I'm proud of that, that is one thing that we do cover on a fairly regular basis.
We also do coverage of interfaith events, not in an institutional sense, to use your word, but more on the ground kind of issues. We've seen, for example, in some of these attacks on mosques and protests outside of mosques recently, that it'll be not only does the local Muslim community make a stand, but also they're joined by allies, rabbis or bishops or other folks. So it's more particular to a story or a development. Another way into it is sort of the personality. There are particular religious leaders who make this a priority for their work, like Bob Roberts in Texas and other folks at Interfaith Youth Corps in Chicago. And we have been writing about work, but sometimes interfaith meetings where it's a group of people getting together, talk about their differences and try to find common ground. It's a hard sell in the newsroom. If there's an outcome, we can do it. If it's after a particularly difficult event, like something like the San Bernardino shootings, if it's tied to some sort of specific news that's happening, we can do it. But just the meetings themselves are a little bit hard to get into. So.
Ditto for me. It's issue-driven, usually, our interfaith dialogues. And the one story that I recall, again, was this Ground Zero mosque story. There was one day when a group of American rabbis from the Northeast came and picketed in front of the mosque. They were picketing for the mosque to be built, and so I covered that, and that was one of the more positive elements of the story that otherwise didn't like.
Hi, my name is Robin Blumner, and I'm with the Center for Inquiry, which is an organization that promotes reason, science, and secular values. And we represent the rising group called the Nuns, the non-religious, which is making up a larger and larger proportion of the American population. But we feel as though, to some degree, we don't get a fair play in the media. And part of the kind of religious privilege that goes along with, for instance, when presidential candidates wear their religion on their sleeve as a shorthand to say that they're good people, this doesn't get questioned at all. You know, where Ted Cruz might say, to be a good president, you wake up in the morning and get on your knees. Well, that really suggests that if you don't get on your knees, you can't be a good president. Maybe you can't be a good person. So why is it that there isn't a little more pushback at the presumption that morality requires a belief in God?
I think that, ironically, the specialized religion reporters do a better job of covering the secular community and the rise of the nuns than sort of more general assignment reporters, which is interesting, but I think that a lot of us do recognize some of the nuances and the changes. My program and others have really looked at this category of the nuns and who are they really and what do they really believe and what are their practices, how are they influencing politics. I did a story about that a couple years ago, talking to people who were raising the very issues you're raising. So I think some of it is an educational, I hate to say, but I think some journalists just don't really get that, and it's easy for them to buy into that shorthand. And so I guess just trying to, you know, help people understand better about the people you represent, help journalists understand that better, But it's definitely an interesting change in American society. I think everybody is trying to look at and figure out, and some people are doing it better than others.
And I would also just add that, right, we're just starting to sort of look at the power of and the influence of that particular group of the religious nuns. One of the things that's challenging for us also is that the people who are experts about this, who are studying the nuns, are themselves sort of agreed or clear about what it means to say that you have no religion. Is it, are a lot of these folks also can have some spirituality? Do they pray? Do they believe in God? And so that's one of the nuances of covering it. But I think you're coming into a period where it's going to be covered more and more because, what the last Pew poll was that, the people with, who say they have no religion are almost equal to the number of people who say that they're evangelical. So the numbers are there. The studies are there. It's just a question of also finding the stories.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, it is misleading to represent them as a monolith because they are very diverse, and that's part of the difficulty of finding voices. I mean, you know, journalists can find voices at the advocacy groups. We know that we can find people who can speak on behalf of that, of maybe one segment, maybe free thought community or maybe secular humanist. But that pie is sliced up in lots of different ways. And if we want a religious voice, you know, if we want a religious voice on a Christian mainline Protestant voice on a Sunday morning, we know exactly where we can go to get that voice. Whereas it's a lot more difficult to find, you know, your kind of your average person who might identify on a survey as a nun. So I don't know if anybody else wanted to add.
Well, there's a certain irony, I'll just real quick, a certain irony of, you know, a lot of these people aren't affiliating with organizations, so then it's hard to find them, you know, because they're not affiliating with organizations, and that's the point of it.
I think it's inevitable that we will be covering your community more. I mean, if you know, the numbers are accurate, 50% of Americans go regularly to church or a synagogue or a temple or a mosque, what about the other 50%? And I think when it comes to campaign coverage and all that, things have been changing, you know, in terms of you know, what's accepted socially, you know, and I'm thinking about gay marriage and other social issues, things will come up. It's inevitable that we're going to be covering people without or non-religious beliefs, as you call them, and that we'd want to know more about them and how diverse they are and how they affect the issues that we cover.
I just one more thing, sorry. But it's not our job. If Ted Cruz wants to say that he wakes up in the morning and the first thing he does is get on his knees, and that provides him value and moral direction, then that's what we report. I mean, that's his business, right? And our job is to report how the candidates find that moral compass, how they live out their values. It's not to push back on those statements. That's your job, but that's not our job.
And whether that has meaning for the base that he's trying to appeal to.
Hello, I'm Brian Fessler. I represent the Church of Scientology, and I'm based out of Nashville, so I'm really familiar with that story. Thank you. My question is, I understand and appreciate the time and budget restraints and so forth that you're under, and that sometimes it would probably be impossible to expect every little factoid to be correct about all times, about all things. But when something is run or aired that is maybe more or less significant to you and maybe really possibly insignificant to the world at large, but it's very significant to our denomination or very important to the people that you're covering, how can we get a correction through, or how can we be heard, or at least have our viewpoint become part of the story?
Well, I guess first there is a process for every news organization to do that, but I guess it's a question of I would just ask anyone who is going to submit a complaint about a story is whether or not they think something's inaccurate, or whether or not it doesn't reflect what the church wants the story to be, or what the religious group wants the story to be. Our job is to write stories that raise questions and that challenge, and in that sense, it's not going to be people necessarily like or don't like. In terms of just getting a correction for information that's
factually inaccurate, you can send an email to the reporter, to the editor. There's a AP, there's a an info@ap.org where you can just send a note that every editor will get to say, and they'll send it to the right, you know, they'll make the decision. But ultimately, you don't have control about the direction of the story. And I know that that's hard, but that is the way that journalism will work.
I think that we don't like to be wrong, and so the extent to which we have made a mistake, we do want to hear about it, and so we can take a look at it and correct it. I mean, we're a broadcast, but yet we have so much material online. Sometimes, you know, in the broadcast, things are out there, but it can be corrected, or there can be a correction or a notation somewhere on the website, and we definitely want to know about that if it's a factual error. You know, if people dispute the direction or the tone or whatever the story, then they're also welcome to let us know that, but that doesn't necessarily get corrected. That might get, you know, that may influence future coverage, though.
And, it's also the question of how it's done. You know, sometimes people will call up and just say, look, this was wrong, or they'll send an email, or they'll send something to an editor, which all of which is fine. Other times the response is more, I mean, the word I'd have to use would be bullying and threatening. And in that case, that's not going to really result in any kind of a conversation about what the story was.
Hi there. My name is Sherilyn Crow. I'm at the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty in Washington, D.C. Thank you guys so much for taking time today for this. My question's a little bit more technical, maybe. I use the AP style book in my work, and I know in 2015 there was a religion section that came out, and I love it. It's so helpful. So, Rachel, I'd love to hear more about that. But also, too, what do you guys do? Hussein, you mentioned earlier how great it would be to have a Mormon in your newsroom to answer questions, and I used to be a Baptist in a newsroom, and I answered questions for people there about different types of Baptists. So, really, the AP style book religion section, that I would love to hear about, and also how you guys also work to get it right and the technical terms you use.
Well, for I think everyone here is familiar with the style book, and thanks for bringing it up. When they a few years ago or a couple years ago now, they asked me to revise all the entries. I was petrified,
it was a huge job. I mean, it really was.
Well, I also just felt like it was such an important responsibility, and there are some very obscure terms in there, and then things that actually I hadn't even heard of before. I ended up sending emails to so many scholars who were so helpful to say, you know, don't use this word, capitalize this word. It's a very technical kind of thing. The good news about the style book now and the era that we're in is I remember this. It used to be it was once a year, and there was one guy in charge of it, and getting a change was so hard. But now, because we have an online system, you know, we change things all the time. So if you see a term that you think is wrong, or something that even needs to be capitalized, or if we're misspelling it, or if there should be, you know, we transliterate words, Hebrew words, Arabic words, if you think we're doing it wrong, I get emails all the time. The editors get emails all the time about that, and they'll respond, and then they'll change it online. And then when the style book comes out once a year, those changes will be reflected in print in the style book itself.
It's funny, in television, you know, ours is a little different. Certainly, we look at the AP style book. RNA, also Religion News Writers Association, has some good resources for style. But some of them don't really translate. Like for television, I know proper religious title might be the Reverend Dr. So-and-so. Well, we don't necessarily say the Reverend Primate, His Holiness. You know, it just doesn't quite work in television. And so, you know, I'm trying to shorthand things without hurting the title, you know what I mean? So sometimes that gets tricky for us, but it is, a religion is really hard. There's a lot. Is Muhammad O or U, A or E, and is Quran with a K or a Q, and different things mean different things to different communities or segments of a community. So it's funny how those little technical things really do make a difference.
Yeah, and it's tricky too. I mean, you know, when we're hiring people, we're not allowed to really discriminate on religion or ethnic origin or whatever, we have a hard job. We're trying to look for diversity, and at the same time, we can't be overtly like, we need a Mormon reporter. Go find a Mormon reporter. I would say though, I mean, I encourage young people who want to go into journalism, and it doesn't matter what background you're in. I mean, it's a great thing to do, and I encourage it. I'm a little more honest with people who come to me now about how it's not as financially rewarding as it used to be, but it's still a great profession. And your experiences, your diversity, is an asset to us.
Hi, I'm Ann Hafton. I'm from North Central Texas. I want to follow up on something, Rachel, you said at the very beginning about using social media for sources. When I was a news director, I could work with a reporter to make sure that they got geographical spread, gender, age groups, and talk to people in big and small congregations, you know, really representative of our church body. And I wonder how that compares to the added transparency, but how do you get sourcing from social media that you really feel like you can count on?
That's a great question, and that's one of the big questions for journalism right now, is that you want to be careful not to quote somebody who it could be a fake account. It could be somebody with no, you know, who presents themselves as an official of something when they actually have no standing. But for me, it's more about doing a series of checks. So I'll see something on Twitter, and it'll say, you know, Reverend so and so in the bio. Then I'll go to the church website and see if there is such a person there. Often I'll actually call the person before quoting the tweet, unless it's somebody that I know. If it's somebody who's a pastor from, say, a major megachurch, I know uses Twitter to get his or her voice out there and likes to be quoted from their Twitter feed, then it's okay to pull from there. But there are, most of the time, you have to make either the phone call or go to the church website, make sure it's the right person, or talk to somebody in the church before you do it. And also it's with photos. So sometimes I know that there was, I think it was last year or the year before, where churches had a kind of Black Lives Matter Sunday where there were special services, and a lot of what happened is the congregations themselves tweeted photos of their ceremonies, and there were lots of interesting visuals, and we wanted to use some of those photos. Then we call, we ask, and then there's a whole series of permissions. So it's not a question of just plucking something off of it. But if I know that, like, you're the spokesperson and that you use your Twitter account, I'll eventually, you know, see the tweet that, or something, or a posting on Facebook, and just grab from it if I know who you are.
Good morning. I'm Yvette Mora, Director of Communications for United Methodist Women. And my question is, how you do it, intentional about including the perspectives of women, not just on articles, you know, issues specifically related to women, like abortion or something like that, but just in general, because women are, for churches anyway, the majority of the population. So how do you include that when many of the church leaders are male?
That is something I've really struggled with over the years, because I don't want to be artificial about it on the one hand, but on the other hand, I want to make sure that diverse voices are represented. And as you say, women play such a key role in so many religious communities, but the top leadership that's put out there is often a man. And so, you know, again, I don't want to be artificial about it, but certainly I do look from time to time, if I have a choice and there's a qualified woman, then I want to raise that voice, very much so. Or also people of color, people from, you know, if I'm doing a generic religion story, I look and say, well, maybe there's somebody other than a Christian that we could go to for this, just to get a different perspective. And that's what I like to do, is get as much differing perspectives. You know, it's that thing where sometimes you go to the people you know because it's easy, and you know they're going to be good, and you know that they know what you want, and they can give it to you, and they can get it to you in a timely manner, and that's why you see the same voices and faces. But I try to break that when I can and look for a different perspective.
It's a real struggle for me as well, trying to find new voices, new people who are willing to talk. Sometimes I find people, and the things that I'm calling about are things that they don't necessarily want to talk about. And I'd like to hear that you're from United Methodist Women, because we're all looking forward in May to the General Conference. And if you would like to be a source for us, or a voice on stories
those are great opportunities to start a relationship with a reporter and get your voices into stories. If it's whether it's the structure of the denomination or the issue of gay rights within the denomination or whatever the other issues that are happening that will happen there, we'd love to get any suggestions you have.
I think sometimes we do cover women, but sometimes for the wrong reason. So, for example, I can think of a story where we covered a woman cleric leading a prayer, and the reason why we cover that story is because that's so, that's not mainstream, and so I wonder sometimes if we're giving the right context when we talk about that. This is so, that these institutions still are very male dominated, are we giving them more exposure because it is so? For the right reasons, I guess. So, I'm conflicted about that. I think we should cover more women, and I think we should represent them the way they are in these institutions. And sometimes I think we look for the something that's sensational, and I don't know if that helps with telling women's stories. So, I'm conflicted about that.
Hi, I'm Molly Horan. I'm from the Parliament of the World's Religions. I have a question. Goes back to Rachel's comments about anticipating stories. We do a lot of interfaith work, and we're getting a lot of coverage now about violence against the Muslim community because of what's going on in the election, and of course we know anti-Muslim rhetoric and anti-minority rhetoric rises during the election cycle. But I wanted to ask specifically about how interfaith groups can work better with the media when we're seeing sort of what's going on behind the scenes before these things erupt. Two examples. I spent some time in Long Island a few years ago when Pamela Geller had been visiting and talked to interfaith leaders about how they wanted to reach out to media, but they didn't want to fuel the fire and give in to the hate mongers and attract coverage. But then, because they didn't do that, one event was canceled, but she ended up picking up three or four more events. And then early last year, she rallied against an event in Texas, and I personally reached out to a lot of media before that event to say, hey, this is about to happen, there's a lot of threats, and I didn't really get a response, but then a month later, there was a Jah Muhammad contest and a shooting, and there was mass media coverage all over the world. So I'd personally like to do my job better because we say, like, we need to involve the media more in order to prevent things like this happening, and I kind of rely on media to be social responsibility reporters, so I'd like some advice just to be able to help bring those conversations in a way that the mainstream public can consume and maybe be a little bit more helpful.
First of all, it sounds like you actually do a great job. You're anticipating what people might need, and you're getting sources together, and you're seeing where the stories are going, and that's really invaluable. And I think one of the things that helps me is that when I'm just looking for new people to put into stories, that you have access to people in different communities that can talk. I understand completely that I can imagine the conversation you had about should we or shouldn't we comment on it. That's a very tough call at the beginning of all of these things. Often what we see, unfortunately, with the news cycle is that sometimes people or reporters will only wake up to the significance of something until after something horrible has happened, instead of sort of seeing it coming, and then you anticipate it. But I would say that just keep doing what you're doing, and that sometimes, unfortunately, you're not going to get a response, but other times you will win, and you'll get people to take up the information that you're sending.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's people would maybe like to get to that story or would get to that story, but they just don't, unfortunately, until it becomes an emergency. But if when the emergency happens, they know who to go to, and it's easy and accessible, and they have names, and they're familiar with what's going on, then immediately you say, oh, yeah, I know a group that's been trying to counter this. And, you know, maybe I didn't cover them before. Maybe I should have. Maybe I just didn't have time. Maybe I wanted to, and I just couldn't get to it. But I can get to them then. So I think it's just, keeping the journalists aware.
Well, this has been a very informative and helpful panel. Is there anything else that anybody would like to add before we close? Thank you. Thank you very much.